This is your first time listening? Thank you. We appreciate it. We look at things from a legal lens with noted attorneys all over the area. We look at big national issues, state issues, local issues, and we chop it all up with some really smart people. I myself am not a lawyer. Audrey, I always wanted to be one, though. I mean, there's still time, right?
Oh, there's absolutely time. You'd be a great attorney. Great.
When this doesn't work out, this whole radio thing, I'll just go to law school and figure that out. Audrey, it's good to see you. Remind people who you've been on this program now. You're like one of our first lawyers we've ever had on Let's Get Legal. And here we're over 3 years into this. Remind people who you are that they're listening for the first time.
Sure. I represent, in our firm, we represent juveniles and adults in criminal cases from traffic to murder, everything in between. And we also represent adults, parents, guardians, foster parents who are being investigated by DCFS or have had their child or children removed from them.
And you worked for the state's attorney's office for many years, and that gives you a unique perspective now on the defense side of things.
I agree, yes. So I was a prosecutor in the prosecutor's office for 20 years and then switched to do defense. So it does. I think it gives me a unique perspective to see both sides.
I was about to say you know the prosecutor's tricks, but that would paint that in a bad light. I guess you know the strategies that they would implement.
Yes,
I shouldn't say tricks.
Right, definitely. Let's not say that.
Right.
But no, the strategies that they use, things that they look for, tools of their trade.
Tools of their trade. I like that. One case I wanted to bring up, and it led us to a host of other questions during the news that I had for you that I just wanted to kind of hash out, is the trial of James Crumbley, which may not be a household name, but he is the father of a school shooter in Michigan. And we've talked about the case, and we, a couple weeks ago, talked about the mother who had been found guilty, and the father was tried separately. And that trial's over, right?
Right. It was just concluded this past week. And just a few days ago, he also was found guilty of all the counts. Just like last month, the wife, the mother of
Jennifer.
Right. She was found guilty of the counts as well.
We kind of talked a little bit about exactly what the counts were, but can you just, for those that didn't listen to that conversation, reset the situation? It's very rare for a mass shooter to have their parents charged. Why were they charged?
Right. In my understanding and doing research and everything, I think this is the first time that the parents of a school shooter, a teenage school shooter, were ever charged under some sort of theory of they're responsible because of their gross negligence in allowing their child to have access to the weapon and knowing the child's mental health. So they weren't charged with first-degree murder or conspiracy like their son was, the high school shooter himself. Rather, they were all charged, the two of them, with involuntary manslaughter.
Mm-hmm.
It's because of their gross negligence that they should have known or realized what their son was about to do.
Right. A lot of people after a shooting go, how do people not know? And blame parents, but there's no criminal charges. This one was a little bit more into, you could argue, was more clear that the parents should have known because the school literally brought the parents in that day and asked them to take their son away, right?
Right. That's my understanding. So I was doing more research since our last time. It's my understanding for the mother, her argument or the prosecutor's theory was more of definite knowledge. She knew her son's mental state. It's my understanding the day before, a teacher had called the mom and said that the son was researching bullets and ammunition online.
Mm-hmm.
Then the morning of the shooting, this child, the high school student, he was drawing about mass shootings and things like that. So they brought the parents in to say that they were concerned about him drawing these graphic diagrams and pictures and wanting to kill himself and shoot up the school. And the parents refused to take their son home. And then, unfortunately, a short time later, in his backpack, I believe, or in his car, but he had a weapon with him and had the weapon from the start of school that morning.
Right.
And the weapon was that the father had bought and the mom had taken him as a I guess a parent would, mm-hmm, to teach the student how to actually use a weapon and gun safety.
Right. And so and that's not a wasn't illegal, right?
Right. No.
That was, in fact, one could argue what you should be doing if you're buying your kid, if your kids have weapons, right?
Right. And so what the father did legitimately buying a weapon for a student, a child, a teenager, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing illegal. And it is, one could argue, responsible parenting for teaching your child and taking them to a range to teach them gun safety.
Right. But where they stepped over the line in the argument of both these juries now, separate trials, were that they should have known or at least had a real strong knowledge of what might happen next.
Right, because the argument from the prosecutors were the parents should have known the son's mental health issues and that he was threats and seen the signs that he wanted to shoot others, that he wanted to commit suicide, that he had these homicidal, suicidal ideations and thoughts.
I know a lot of people will have probably celebrated these, celebrated is the wrong word, said that this was the right decision by a jury, right? That, yes, parents should be held responsible for their kids' actions in these regards if the parents themselves were negligent, which the jury say that they were. It does open up a lot of questions, though, moving forward, if this is going to be the norm, if this is going to happen more often, and maybe in some cases, there are probably parents that legitimately have no idea something like this is possible, right?
Right. And so regular parents, so maybe a school doesn't know ahead of time. They don't bring in the parents ahead of time to say, or the mom doesn't get a call from the teacher the day before saying, right, we saw something on their school computers. It's just a parent that doesn't know. A lot of parents probably don't monitor what their students are watching, what they're posting online. They're not reading their child's journals. A teenager, you're not going through the kid's backpack, things right, like that. You're not going through their school locker to see what their thoughts are or talking to their friends or seeing if they have friends. So a lot of parents could legitimately say they didn't know. So now are those parents required to do all that, to be up on Facebook? Alternatively, the argument is, yes, you should be monitoring what your children are doing and saying and who they're connecting with. Not just because they may be a threat to others, but they may be victimized by some adult who may lure them to do something inappropriate or get them wrapped up into something that they shouldn't.
Right. And if the precedent now is, and this is just Michigan, obviously, but if they're going to start charging the parents with these sorts of issues, then maybe they need to be more on top of things. And you can argue, like you're saying, generally speaking, probably should be on top of them anyways. Why were James and Jennifer tried separately, even though they were charged with, I think, the same stuff, right?
Right. I believe that they were charged with the exact same crimes for the exact same children, students, adults, teachers right, that were unfortunately perished in the shooting. The reason is, I believe, they're conflicting defenses. So the mother, the wife, she went to trial first. And it's my understanding in researching this, her argument was, and her defense was, she didn't know. It was the husband and the school that knew, and they were the ones that should have done something. So she and her husband could not have juries at the same time when their defenses are conflicting. So if she had just said the school should have done something more and not blame the husband, then perhaps maybe if the defense wanted or the state wanted and the judge granted to have them tried at the same time with double juries.
I'm kind of curious about how that works, like operationally, like two people you think might be charged at the same time for the same crime. At what point does it come up what your defense is going to be? I didn't know that that had to come out even before a trial began. Is that a judge asking both defense teams, hey, what are your arguments here so we can determine how this works or if we're going to split these two defendants up?
So some of the defenses, the defense attorneys have to present to the prosecutor ahead of time, self-defense, things like that. Others are, it comes up what a possible defense would be is if the prosecutor files a motion to try the defendants together at the same time.
Ah.
Then the defense attorneys respond in arguments or written motions to the judge saying, no, we can't because our defenses are conflicting.
Okay. Now, if Jennifer had, she was found guilty, let's say she was found not guilty, and the jury bought the argument that it was James's, her husband's fault instead, at James's trial, can the prosecutors use that jury's decision to help charge James? Like, see, like another jury already agreed that it's James's fault, and I'm presenting that as evidence here in this trial. Is that allowed?
No, that wouldn't be allowed. Even though it's my understanding, all but one witness were identical, so they had most of the witnesses were identical in their testimony. You can't use that.
Right. So it could be said that a defense team that splits a couple up to and place blame on one couple, well, that might seem to be acrimonious in a relationship or might butt heads in a relationship, it might be an effective defense strategy.
Right. It's definitely, for any time there's co-offenders, co-defendants, it's a great strategy for the first one to blame the second defendant. And then so the wife blamed the husband that he should have known he should have taken action. And then the second defendant say, no, it should have been the first one.
Just to point fingers at each other.
Correct. That's the best way to confuse a jury is to say the other person who's not at trial, who you don't hear from, they're the ones that are responsible.
Okay. You told me something fascinating, too, that if they had both been tried together, I was like, okay, so they're both tried together. There's a jury. They decide, you know, that they're both guilty or both not guilty. That's not quite how it works, is it?
No, right. So even if both defendants, so wife and husband, do trials at the same time, they each get their own juries. So you have two juries going on at the exact same time. So logistically, it gets a little bit
like one
chaotic.
On the left, one on the right?
Right. Correct, yeah. And if the jury box isn't big enough, you just add chairs to the front or to the side to make room.
So what if there's more than two defendants? Same thing?
Correct. Yeah, 3, 4, 5. You get 3, 4, 5 sets of juries. Or if one defendant wants a jury trial and one wants a bench trial, then say the wife had a jury trial, you have a jury for her, and then the judge is just deciding the fate of the husband at the same time, listening to the same witnesses.
And what if there's different witnesses for different defendants that are tried at the same time?
Then you get a shuffling game. So you take a break while the deputies take out the one jury who can't listen to that evidence, and they go sit back in their jury room and present the witnesses, and then they flip-flop. For example, statements of a defendant, like if they confess. Yes, then the jury for the wife can hear about the husband's and vice versa.
Oh, interesting stuff. Okay, that was just some sort of logistical stuff I was curious about. Audrey Anderson from Anderson Attorneys and Advisors. We're not done yet. Where can people reach you at?
They can contact us through our website or give us a call, 630-877-5800.
We'll take a break. You looked up in the air as you did that.
I'm trying to remember. I don't call myself.
You don't call
yourself. Hopefully I got my right number.
We'll make sure we got it right. We'll take this break and have more with Audrey Anderson from Anderson Attorneys and Advisors on WGN. We have confirmed, Audrey, your number is 630-877-5800. But you're right. You don't call yourself.
Right. I don't call myself. And if I do leave voicemails, it just seems natural.
Yes.
But, oh, my gosh.
630-877-5800. It's only important our listeners know that number, Audrey.
True.
You're the one answering on the other end. Let's get to Lisa. Lisa has a comment about the case we were just talking about where the two parents of the school shooter in Michigan were both charged and found guilty of crimes for not doing something before the shooting happened. Lisa, what are your thoughts? Thanks for joining us.
Oh, hi, John. Hi, Audrey. Okay, so my question, put the parents aside, let's say, what is the school's responsibility in all of this?
Yeah.
They call the parents in, say, we're afraid of your son, take him home. They say, oh, no, I don't want to take him home. You keep him. But they don't check his backpack. They don't keep him in a room by himself. Here, go back to class. You know, what is their responsibility? Legally, what's their responsibility?
Great question, Lisa, because they can't legally force them to go home, right, Audrey?
Right. They can't legally force the parents to take their son home. However, you're right. They have the bar for them to be able to search a locker, a car, is very low. So if they saw that there was drawings in his notebook, which they did, they absolutely had the right to go search it, and they would have found the weapon, my understanding.
Right, and as Lisa said, they could have put him with someone in the school just to sit there. Hey, we can't send you home, but you're going to sit in the assistant principal's office and sit here the whole day.
Correct, and they could have done that. And if the parents refused to take the child home and they thought that the child was such a threat, they could have called DCFS to have DCFS come and take protective custody of the child because he was a threat to himself or a harm to others.
Right, and it's really easy to play Monday morning quarterback, right? Or Monday, whatever it's called.
Yeah.
Where you're just retrospectively looking back at this, but this one seemed so glaringly obvious. I mean, the fact that they called the parents almost like shows how much they were worried about this, right? And showing this stuff. So to Lisa's point then, could they charge someone at the school criminally, potentially?
Potentially, I suppose. It does technically fit the definition of charging someone with involuntary manslaughter. It doesn't say it's only limited to parents or guardians. So if a prosecutor wanted to be brave enough and be precedent, like these prosecutors did with parents, they could try to do the dean or some administrator or a teacher for not taking action.
Might be a tougher sell because it would seem to be, I mean, that's in the scope of what they do, but it'd be quite a circumstance, right? I mean, these are people doing their jobs as opposed to parents who are supposed to intimately know what's happening in their kids' lives. It may be a harder stretch for a jury.
Oh, absolutely. It definitely would be a harder stretch for the school because they did do what they could. I mean, they did reach out to the parents. They didn't wait till the end of the day. It's my understanding they saw it. They immediately, first thing to close in the morning, they called the parents right away. So that's so said it's serious.
I could just see it. Even if they did charge someone, I could see a dean or a school administrator being more sympathetic to a jury, and that I thought that's what I did in my time. It's a little bit more, I guess, less connected than parents. But could civilly something happen potentially with the district even as a whole?
Absolutely. There's definitely civil liability, I think. I don't practice civil law, but
right.
I'm just researching this a little bit just because I was curious myself. I do think that, unfortunately, the victims' families do have a a great argument against the school district. They obviously have deeper pockets than these parents do, perhaps. And so civilly, they could go after the school and the school district.
Yeah, it's so hard. And the reason I said the Monday morning quarterback thing was just the idea of, I know people know, it's probably a lot different nowadays than it was when I was in high school, right? Or it just still, I imagine people don't think it's going to happen in their school, right?
Right.
And they don't want to go completely overboard, check every kid's backpack. But this one just seemed so preventable. But again, we aren't in the room in the moment that it happens, right?
Right. Because who knows really what a kid's going through? Because sometimes maybe a child is just being bullied and that's their thoughts. And that's how they're expressing their thoughts on paper. They have no inclination or intention or ability to actually carry it out. And so why punish them to put them through all this if that's really not the case? So how is the school to know all the time to call parents or a guardian about this?
Right. And I just want to think, and I'm sure, even though I know the parents have become a villain in this story and they will, you know, suffer the consequences of their inaction. But boy, I bet you tell them afterwards, if you knew what you knew now, I bet no doubt they'd bring that kid home, right? You'd have to imagine, no doubt.
Right. You would think, I did read a little bit about the mom and how she testified on her own behalf, and she says she would not have done anything differently.
Oh, really?
Right. That's what I was somewhat shocked. You think if a defendant was getting up, you would try to
make them as sympathetic as possible.
Right. And so she says she would never have changed a thing. But I guess her argument or the defense was she didn't realize that her son would actually do something.
I see what you're saying. If she had admitted that maybe...
Correct, that she made a mistake and she knew and she should have done something differently.
I'd have to get them out of a courtroom to really figure that out.
Anyways, I'm sure on their own they think that.
It's just a heartbreaking situation. Okay, we're going to have more with Audrey Anderson from Anderson Attorneys and Advisors in a bit. 630-877-5800. We're a minute late to the news, though. Let's go to the newsroom right now here on WGN. It's 636 on WGN. Let's get legal powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. With Audrey Anderson from Anderson Attorneys and Advisors. A little bit later in this half hour before we wrap up, we will chat with someone about the NCAA's strict enforcement of anything, quote unquote, March Madness, which you know is their thing. They own that trademark and they protect it mercilessly. In fact, they are trying to stop a wildlife organization from using the term Marsh Mania. Marsh Mania. Why do they protect it so much? And are they allowed to do that? We'll talk about that a little bit later. Audrey Anderson, Anderson Attorneys and Advisors. We were talking about the Michigan school shooting case and the parents that were charged and found guilty of negligence, right? Is that what the ultimate was?
Involuntary manslaughter, right.
That's worse than negligence. Okay. I think. And 630 wanted to know, are we going to start arresting the parents of gang members and juveniles in Chicago that are causing all the havoc? And there's kind of a clear difference between what the Michigan parents, what happened with them, and maybe every, I don't want to say every day, but unfortunately, a lot of things that happen in our city, mass gatherings, people carjacking, that sort of stuff. There is a difference between the two, right, Audrey?
There is. It's so, I guess if the prosecutors wanted to be very bold in Chicago to try to stem this, is if they can show that the parents knew ahead of time what their child was going to be doing. So if parents knew and saw the TikTok videos or whatever, that kids are going to meet up to do a shooting or to hijack a car,
right,
and the parents knew that the kids were gathering or that their son or daughter took their gun, then yeah, if a prosecutor wants to think outside the box and do something, they could. They
right.
could very well charge that. And I know some mothers have been charged with crimes for inciting their daughters to get into fights.
Oh, really?
At school. So that's happened. I don't know if it's in Chicago. I have read in other states that that's happened.
Mm.
So that's something that they definitely do.
Right. And it doesn't have to be your kid saying, I'm going to go out and be a carjacker. Because obviously this in the Michigan, it wasn't the kid saying, I'm going to go up and shoot at the school. But it would have to be, what would be the level of chart? Is it a matter of a reasonable person would know that your kid was about to do something like this?
Right. So it's not only that a reasonable parent knows that a child would do something, but the parents somehow facilitated, helped in some sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
So in the Michigan case with the school shooting, dad bought the gun, mom took the son to learn how to shoot the gun.
Right.
So they actually did something to further the son's ability to carry out the mass shooting. So I guess when the banger situation in Chicago, if one of the parents bought the gun and they taught the kid how to shoot it,
right,
then yeah.
Yeah,
if
charged.
Yeah, if a kid did a drive-by or rob someone or carjack someone with that gun, then suppose the argument could be made that the parents could be charged.
But you can't charge them with bad parenting. It's Correct. Basically the ultimate thing. You can't just then pick up your kid and go, did you not know where your kid was and what they were doing? And if they say, no, I didn't, they're not charged with the crime.
Right.
It's and not it's a crime.
Right. And it maybe just not even the parent didn't care. Maybe they're just too busy. Like they're at jobs trying to support the family because things get expensive. So they work the night shift or they work a couple shifts and they can't be on top of everything their child's doing.
Okay, let's talk about this story because we have teased it all week, the Volkswagen story. It's a really interesting one about this family that, well, you set it up for us a little bit. This was a family that had, speaking of carjackings, their car stolen, but the kid was in the backseat, right?
Right, so it was a pregnant mom. She had gotten home. It's my understanding it was the afternoon, I think.
In the suburbs, right?
In the suburbs. In here in Illinois. So the mom was got out of her car. She's pregnant. She hadn't quite gotten to the back seat to open up to take her toddler out. I don't even know if he was a year and a half or two, three armed individuals came up to her, pushed her down, got in the car and drove off, but literally drove the car over her. Like they broke her pelvis.
Gosh.
I mean, she was severely injured. So she had the wherewithal to call 911 right away because instead of saying someone stole my car, she said someone kidnapped her son who was in the car, thinking it was a kidnapping, not just her car.
Right.
Her Volkswagen was stolen. Her thought was obviously her toddler's in the backseat who can't help himself.
Which, by the way, isn't it a kidnapping at that point?
Yes, you would think.
I mean, right?
That's what people think.
It is. Yeah.
Like, how would you know if it's the difference between taking your car or your kid? You would presume it's that they want your child, not necessarily your car.
Right. So they took the thing away and at some point, someone thought, was it the police or her, is like, oh, wait, we can track my car, right?
Right. So I'm not sure whose idea it was. I'm sure law enforcement, because they're on the ball for these things, will see what type of car it is, how new it is. Does it have a tracking system? And the mom said, yes, actually it does. And it's got the system. It's a newer car. So call Volkswagen. And then the carrier, who I think might have been Verizon, was a carrier for that to say, let us know the GPS location for it.
Track the car, yeah.
Yeah. And they refused.
Why?
Because the free trial experiments for that had lapsed.
So like when you buy a new car, you get maybe like 30, whatever it is, 30 days, 60 days, we'll track your car for free. Then you pay a monthly fee for this. That had already expired. So they said no.
Correct.
Even though physically they probably had the ability just to like ping it up and be able to get it.
Right. And so law enforcement, obviously people are like, well, what's the big deal? Police can do it. Well, yes, police can go through the steps to try to locate the car through a judge, but that takes hours.
Oh my God, that's right. You're going to have
it's
to get hours. A judge. You can't
right.
just, and that's for a good reason, right? We want searches to be, police not to have over surveillance. We want them to have to go to a judge to get these things. Mm-hmm. That system is designed to protect us. But in that moment, when the woman who owns this car is saying, please, I have a child in the back seat of it. And
right,
did they just get the wrong person on the phone who just like, because I can imagine that whether it's Verizon or Volkswagen, whoever's at the top is thinking, what are you doing? They should have said yes in that moment.
Right. But the person answering the phone, like, this is their policy. How do they know if it's for real?
Right.
If this is,
I know.
So you understand the poor person, the employee is going, no, thanks. But then the time it takes, the prosecutor has to be contacted. The police officer takes forever to write the search warrant or it's the document for the prosecutor to review, then they go to the judge to sign it, then they have to reach out to Verizon or Volkswagen to ping it. That takes hours, 5 hours, 4 hours if you're in a real rush, whereas if you can just call some number.
Right.
So now, thankfully, there's a law that just went into effect January 1st of this year that there's supposed to be a hotline. So law enforcement can contact the hotline for all these different car manufacturers and dealerships and things so they can automatically get this information. And then within 72 hours, the officers, once the situation has calmed down a little bit, they then have to go in front of the judge. And the judge then affirms, yes, it was correct, or no,
right,
it isn't.
Okay, so that's a new law, and that is good. I would say that's like a no-brainer to me. I do want to update people who didn't follow the story. The child was located safe in Waukegan.
Yes.
And that is certainly good news. And she then had a healthy baby boy, right?
She did. And so how the child was located, some good citizen just happened to see some toddler wandering on the side of the road.
Oh, my goodness.
And so that's how the child was found. The citizen called 911 and police found the child. So Volkswagen didn't help, unfortunately, for them. But yes, the child was found safe and sound.
Okay, that's good. And she gave birth on June 26th of last year to her baby, Noah. Okay, I'm glad they changed that law. See, that's an example of that one should have probably been in the books already. But until, you know, lawmakers like all of us, we lack the imagination to even wonder what could possibly happen. Until bad things happen, sometimes we don't even know what should or shouldn't be law.
Very true.
Audrey Anderson, Anderson Attorneys and Advisors, thanks for a little extended time today. We appreciate it.
Oh, thanks as always for inviting me down. It's great to sit down here and see the Green River.
Yeah, you're excited. And I like that you sitting in a dim studio with me.
I do. It's nice ambiance.
We haven't turned on the bright lights yet, even though the sun is setting behind us here in the next 20 or 30 minutes. AndersonAA.com, 630-877-5800. Who should be calling you?
Any adult that has issues, criminal issues for themselves or one of their children.
Right. And I just want to say that we've talked about, we don't have time today to talk about DCFS. We've talked a lot about it. Put Audrey Anderson's, and it'll be right at the top of your contact list because it'll be AA. Audrey Anderson, 630-877-5800. Even if you're the best parent in the world and would never do anything wrong, there are bad actors out there that might call DCFS on you, not to scare anyone. But if they ever come to the door, call Audrey right away, right, Audrey?
Right. And if it's not you, maybe someone will reach out to you asking if you know of anyone.
Right. Exactly.
A friend or family member has an issue.
Exactly. So go to my contacts, 630-877-5800 for Audrey Anderson. Audrey, it was great to have you. Chat soon, okay?
Yes, thank you so much.
We'll take a break. I turn off my mic instead of Audrey's. I'm a professional. We'll take a break and then we'll talk about the NCAA trademarks after this on WGN.